Welcome to Raw Talk on M88. Call in with your questions or comments. Toll free 1-866-730-4921. Or submit your question to Dear DJ at M88.org. Now, it's time for some Raw Talk on M88.
And welcome to Raw Talk here on M88. I'm your host, Yo, and thanks so much for joining us tonight. And before we get started with tonight's program, real quick, I wanted to remind everyone that next Saturday is the M88 Golf Tournament. I know that money's tight right now. In fact, that's what we're talking about tonight. And the situation is no different for M88, non-profit, non-commercial. We need money. And one of the ways we raise money is by inviting you guys to come out and play golf. And all the proceeds from this event help support the music and ministry of M88. And we're going to be out at Isleta Golf Course this year. I actually had a chance to play on that course last year at the SCA Golf Tournament. It's a really nice course. And we'd love for you to come on out and be a part of the tournament this year, help support all that happens here on the station of M88. So if you want to join us, you can get signed up. Register right now at M88.org. Even if you don't have a full team of four people, get signed up. We'll put you on a team with some nice people. So don't worry about it. It'll all work out just fine. And we'd love for you to come out. It's next Saturday, sponsored again this year by Southern Boulevard Automotive. Want to thank them for all that they do for the station and for sponsoring the tournament again this year. And I'm sure John's team will win, just like they do every year. My team pretty much doesn't have a chance at all, despite practicing Tiger Woods on the Nintendo Wii all throughout the weekend. Tonight, we are talking a little bit about money. And joining us tonight, we have Kirby Anderson, a guy who's written a book called Making the Most of Your Money in Tough Times, which pretty much is what everyone wants to do right about now. Mr. Anderson, everyone's thinking about, hey, what do I do with all my money? Things are crazy right now. What am I supposed to do? So I appreciate you joining us tonight and sharing some of your expertise.
Well, thank you. One of the things as a talk show host I've found is I've interviewed lots of people that have tried to give us some perspective on what's been happening over the last year or so, and also just how we apply some of those biblical perspectives to the whole issue of money, which is a topic that the Bible talks about more than almost any other topic except love.
Yeah, and with everyone so concerned about money at this point, you know, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. And I know I've had some questions and concerns about this, so I'm excited about tonight's topic. Now, it's kind of interesting when I was reading the introduction of your book. You wrote this book. Well, why don't you tell the story of what happened as you were writing this book, like how you were writing it because you thought maybe some tough times were coming, and then as you're writing it, those times came, and just talk about the process of writing this book as a lot of that started to become reality.
Sure. You know, I had been writing a series with the same publisher as this one, Harvest House, and it was a biblical point of view series, and we'd done a biblical point of view on Islam, homosexuality, intelligent design, spiritual warfare, and in the midst of that, I said, you know, I really wouldn't mind writing something that dealt with the issue of the economy and what is happening. And they kind of said, well, can we postpone it because we want to finish the series, which I understood. And so when I started the book, it was really a while back, but I kind of had the sense that we were headed for some tough times. As you read in my introduction, by the time I finished the book, we had hit those tough times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't say that I was able to predict AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the collapse of the housing market, but I did see down the road some things that are still there, and that is such things as unfunded mandates, the issue of how much money do we have for Medicare and Social Security, some of the issues which we're debating right now in Congress, health care and health care reform, questions about whether or not the United States, which used to be the largest creditor nation in the world, has now become the largest debtor nation in the world. And so it just seemed to me that that was a book that should come out. And, of course, as you know, it's out now and is really just an attempt on the front couple of chapters to kind of set forth biblical principles about everything from materialism and consumerism to giving and spending and saving and insurance. But then the latter chapter spends some time looking at the circumstances we find ourselves in. Is America going broke? Do we have significant economic dislocations? What should we do in terms of policy? So I look at it both as what an individual can do in the midst of some of these tough times, as well as what I think should be some wise governmental policies about what we should do also as we deal with these tough times.
Well, you certainly struck when the iron was hot when it came to this topic, and I want to start actually towards the back of the book because, you know, the bigger picture is kind of what everyone's focusing on right now, what's happening in the government and whatnot. In a broad sense, what is your assessment of the current financial situation for our nation?
Well, and I don't want to sound all doom and gloom because I do believe that there are some things that we need to deal with, but let's just take that comment I made just a minute ago. Is America going broke? Well, I'm not the first one to have raised this question. People with better economic credentials than either of us have been saying, you know, as we look at the circumstances in which we find ourselves, the what I call the unfunded mandates, those kinds of entitlement programs that are going to be paid out over the next few decades, because as the baby boom generation retires, they're going to be drawing down a fair amount of those resources, some of which exist, others which will have to be generated every year. That's the first issue. The second is, even apart from what is happening internally and domestically, you have to answer another question. What is happening externally in terms of the international market? And on one of the pages, page 126, I use the story that Warren Buffett uses oftentimes. He tells a story of two islands side by side, one called Thriftville, one called Squanderville. They're both working very hard, but eventually Thriftville begins to realize that they can produce a little bit more. Squanderville looks at those and say, oh, we'll buy all your goods and services, and then we don't have to work so hard, so we'll offer you some IOUs. So those are kind of called squander bonds. And then later, as they are selling more and more of those, Thriftville says to themselves, I'm not so sure I want these squander bonds. I want money, so I want squander bucks. And so they get squander bucks, and they use that to buy the island. Anyway, you can take the story all the way down, but eventually Thriftville owns the island of Squanderville. Now, you know, every time I've given this message, whether it's on my radio show or when I speak to individuals or to groups, I oftentimes say, can you tell me which nation is which? And, of course, almost instantaneously, everybody says, yeah, I feel like the United States is Squanderville, and, say, China or Japan is Thriftville. And I think that's a pretty good analogy of where we are. We have put ourselves into a situation that is not going to be easy to dig ourselves out of, because when you look at the amount that we have to borrow from other countries, we are talking about, in round numbers, about $1 trillion from China, at least 200 plus billion from a variety of other countries, which would be things like Japan, Saudi Arabia, as a variety of other countries, some of which we don't even know the names of because they actually pass the money through Caribbean banks. Well, you can figure out that it, in a sense, puts the United States in a situation corporately that isn't unlike the situation a lot of Americans find themselves individually. If we were to open the phones tonight and have people call in and say, you know, do you have credit card debt? How much of a debt you have? I think you'd be pretty surprised to find out that individuals are in debt, but we as a country are in debt. And so I think it comes back to applying biblical principles to say, you know, thrift and saving and giving and investing are good things. And we have been in a society for too long that has been willing to spend more than brings in, both corporately and individually. And it's time for us to come back to some of those key biblical principles.
When I was going through this and thinking about, you know, the big picture stuff and what we're hearing in the news all the time, one of the things that occurred to me, especially for younger people, high school, college, maybe just barely, you know, getting started in their professional career or whatnot, and it almost seems like a cynical question, but I thought, you know, I'm sure it's going to occur to some people. Some people may be asking, well, why should we care about all this stuff? The government's spending a lot of money. Yeah, we got that trade deficit, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't affect me. Why should I care as an individual? Especially, I'm so young. I got my entire financial future in front of me. It doesn't affect me. I mean, how would we respond to someone who would ask, you know, why should I care about all this?
Well, I'd love to talk to those individuals, the millennial generation, or even the little older generation called the baby buster generation. They are on the front end of some investments that they could make. And really, this again brings back to kind of one of the great wonders of compounding interest. If you, in your 20s, set aside just a little bit of money each month into, it could be anything from an IRA or a CD, or even you buy a gold coin or whatever it might be, but especially those things that generate interest, and that would certainly be things like an IRA, CD, even different kinds of stocks. By the time you retire, If you're spending a small amount in your 20s, that has more of an impact in terms of your possible nest egg than if you don't do anything and wait till your 40s or 50s. It just makes sense. So that's the first thing. I mean, right now would be a time to apply some of these principles in my chapter on saving and investing. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you're asking the other question. Well, I don't care about federal deficits and a national debt and a trade deficit. It doesn't affect me. Well, yes, it does, because the bottom line is there comes a limit to how much money we can borrow. And I think we've pretty much hit it right now. President Obama, I think, is coming face-to-face with the fact that the Chinese are not going to let us borrow another $1 trillion from them, and you don't know where that's going to come from. So if you can't borrow more, then you only have a couple of options. Government can only get money in one of three ways. It either can tax it, but there's only so much you can tax. It can borrow it, but now we see there's only so much you can borrow, or it can print it. And once you have the Federal Reserve starting to print money, when you have more dollar bills than you have assets, what happens is that becomes inflation. And so every person listening to this, especially if they were making those investments, are going to be getting paid back with money that is devalued because their inflation has taken place. So the impact that this could have on you would be significant. Because the only other way we can do it is just default, and that is to say, okay, we can't meet all the needs for Social Security and Medicare. We won't pay anybody, and that leads then to complete chaos and collapse or a default on the system, and I don't think any politician is going to do that. Mm-hmm. So even though they may not want to print more money and print more dollar bills and more currency, that is the only politically viable option left. And, of course, the impact that that has on you is significant, because if you don't like paying $3 or $4 a gallon for gas, imagine when it's $10 a gallon. It isn't because gasoline's got more expensive. It's because the dollar is worth a lot less. And now you're paying twice as much for gasoline, but you're also paying twice as much for food, twice as much for rent, twice as much for everything that you are a part of. And so you can see that even though you can say, I really have no interest at all in the federal debt or even in trade deficits, long term it will have a devastating impact on you, but even short term it will have an impact that is certainly not going to be positive.
From what I've heard and from what I've read, we haven't hit the inflationary stage of the situation yet. And I'm weak on history, but wasn't it back in the 70s the last time when we had a serious problem with inflation? And how did that affect everything?
Okay, and that's a good example, because we have inflation examples not only in the United States. Probably the best example that people talk about oftentimes is Zimbabwe or some of the South American countries. Yes, last time we've had a real issue with inflation was back in that time. I write a daily commentary, and recently I did one on, okay, when might inflation hit? Mm-hmm. And here I would be honest enough to say there are some differing opinions. Some say that maybe next year we're starting to see inflation in a significant way. Others have said that, well, it would take until the economy really turns around and begins to grow significantly, and so they're saying 5 years from now. So you get everyone from though people saying that you're not even going to get through the year 2009 without seeing significant inflation, all the way to those who would postpone it a few years. But in either case, it is going to be something that you aren't going to want, because, again, as I said, let's say you have investments. You put something into a CD or an IRA. You bought stock, whatever it might be. When you get paid back, you're going to be paid back with devalued dollars, and so the real rate of return that you were looking for isn't going to be what you thought it was going to be.
Hmm. Now, this whole issue of money, and this was something that kind of struck me as I was preparing for tonight's program, this whole issue of money is one of those issues of life that we kind of put in a different compartment from our Christianity. You know, we often have our money life, and we take care of the bills and worry about all that. And then we have our Christian life, the Bible studies, going to church, and doing, you know, good deeds in the community, ministering, all that stuff. And it's one of those areas that we don't often integrates as much into our Christian life. Why would you say that's a mistake to keep money and financial issues in a different compartment from Christianity?
Yes, and And in some respects, might even say, why has that happened?
Yeah.
Because if you go back early on in my book, I talk about the fact that there was a time in which to talk about money was to talk about it biblically. In other words, to ask what was a just price, to ask what is a price would be to ask what is a just price. There really is no dichotomy. If you look at just the verses in the Bible that deal with money, you have at least 140 verses that deal with money. If you add all the others that talk about different forms of money, which would then include things like gold and silver, you're up to 800 verses, which gets you back to the point that it is one of the most frequently discussed topics in the Bible. Now, that being said, I teach occasionally at Dallas Seminary as a visiting lecturer, and I've had other individuals, some that have graduated from that seminary, another one that Randy Alcorn has written a book on money that graduated from Western Conservative Baptist Seminary, and I've had various individuals who have graduated from seminary saying, you know, we never really talked about money in our 4 or in some cases 3 years of seminary. So you can see why oftentimes it isn't addressed. Then, one very important aspect of money is giving, and oftentimes I've noticed that pastors are somewhat unwilling to talk about giving from the pulpit because it sort of seems self-serving. You know, if I talk about money from the pulpit, I'm then sort of implying, well, then you need to support me at Calvary Chapel or, you know, wherever it might be. And that's not exactly what some pastors want to do, so they are hesitant to do so. But I think, as you point out a minute ago, there is a real danger because God really does hold us accountable for how we use money and even the misuse of money. Probably the most famous passage that most people have heard, 1 Timothy 6:10, where it talks about the love of money is the root of all evil. That doesn't say money is the root of all evil, but it does tell us that money is important, and it is a very significant measure of your spiritual maturity. It helps you understand, for example, the kind of attitude that you have. And in Matthew 6, we know, for example, that Jesus teaches that you can't love both God and mammon, God and money. And so it isn't so much how much money you have. It isn't so much what you own. The real issue is what owns you. And if you have a proper biblical attitude towards money, then first of all, I believe that God blesses you. Second of all, you understand the biblical principles of giving, the biblical principles of saving. You recognize some of the biblical principles about the dangers of debt and credit, and you're going to live a life in harmony with what God has called you to do. But the sad reality is that this isn't the only book. There's excellent ministries over the years that have really focused on the issue of money and finances, but it's still an area where a lot of Christians aren't necessarily operating from a biblical perspective because they simply have not been taught some of those perspectives in a Sunday school class or even in the church.
I was thinking that maybe what we could do to help out with the situation of being taught this stuff is to start young and in the home by teaching our kids. And it seemed like a good idea to me, but I'm not the smartest guy when it comes to financial situations. So I was thinking, well, I'm going to ask Kirby Anderson because, hey, he's going to be my guest. So I'll just be selfish and say, hey, what should I be teaching my kids even at a young age before they're 10 about money to help prepare them for when they get older so that they can have, A, a biblical perspective on money, and, B, just be smart about it?
Well, I think that's certainly something we should all be doing, because if you think about it, there are some opportunities within the home that early on establish some patterns. And whether it was to use my book or the books and resources of Crown Financial or Christian Money or a variety of other organizations, it seems to me that at a very young age, what I would want to do, and I did with my children, was we were to give them an allowance. And that was something that they would receive for the chores that they would do. And then, when they were very young, what we would do is we'd break this up even sometimes into pennies or quarters or whatever the denomination might be, and we'd have envelopes. And we'd have one envelope, this is money that you're going to give to the Lord. And so we'd teach them immediately about the idea of giving to the church and giving to Christian organizations. And then we would have another envelope, and that would be for something that perhaps, especially as they got older, that would be necessary for their school. So it's kind of like this idea of work. And so they would set something aside. Maybe they wanted to get a special set of markers, or my girls really love these stamps. And so they wanted to get these special stamps. They weren't necessary for school, but they were kind of a lot of fun. And then the third area was this was for saving, and then we started a savings account, and actually each one of them had their own passbook. So before these kids really even knew how to read and write, they already were sort of getting used to the idea of giving, of saving, and spending. Now, as they got older, especially in junior high school and high school, then we obviously increased the amount and also, in a sense, turned loose some of the reins and encouraged them to make choices. And then they could decide, for example, what church outreach or missionary outreach they would want to be a part of. Many of them went on a mission trip themselves, so they saw the opportunity of asking their friends and some of the family members to support them on going on a mission trip. And so it began to be sort of a lifelong process of learning some of these principles, not only theologically or theoretically, but also practically, so that as they are now adults, because all of my kids are either in their 20s or one is in her 30s, I've actually taken those principles and continued them on in their own families.
That's some good advice. I'm going to have to make note of the envelope idea. I like that idea a lot. We're talking with Kirby Anderson, author of the book Making the Most of Your Money in Tough Times, here on Raw Talk. And going to the next step, Kirby, what about in youth group? You know, often you go to youth group, you're in high school, and you go to your church group, and, you know, they teach you not to have sex, not to drink, not to do drugs, not to do anything bad. And then they throw a pizza party so that you are distracted enough that you don't go out and do all those bad things. And it occurs to me that, you know, those are all very important things to teach young people with all the temptations that we're facing right now. But you got kids these days who have credit cards. They have their own cell phones running up a cell phone bill somewhere of digital money that they don't see. You know, they're already engaged, you know, buying stuff off of iTunes. Again, you know, digital transaction. I'm not really losing anything. It's all imaginary. That they're immersed in this world. How can we better prepare kids, especially in high school and college groups, to deal with the world of digital money transfers where you don't really feel the pain of spending anything?
Right. Again, I've got a lot of points. That's almost a book in itself. But I'll make two points. Point number one is that I believe that the church, and that by that I mean either pastors, elders, Sunday school leaders, youth leaders, need to warn young people about the dangers of overspending. And the reason I say that is I document a little bit in my book, and even next week when I'm going to be teaching on that aspect about how finances have been misused by the current generation because of that digital transfers. You know, you get something down from iTunes, it doesn't really feel like you actually spent money, and mm-hmm. you put it on a credit card, and you get automatic transfers. And so there is a real problem, because now you are seeing lots of kids not only graduate from college with debt. That has been a chronic problem for some time, but now we're seeing kids, as you were implying, going to college with a significant amount of debt. Mm-hmm. The average credit card debt in America today, $9,000. So we are not talking about small amounts. And these are run up very easily because, as you see, it's one thing for me to give you your allowance, $10, and say, okay, that's all you got, or, you know, maybe $25, or whatever the age of the child might be, and it's in cash, and once you've spent your allowance, there's no more to spend. But when I give you a credit card, and it doesn't seem like you're spending money, it's very easy to find yourself into debt. So the first thing I think we should talk about is that the church really needs to warn young people that this is a very dangerous situation that they can find themselves in. And the Proverbs teach us that a person in debt is like a slave. So that's point number one. Point number two, I would say this to the parents, you cannot always rescue your children. What I think happens so often when we get into these issues of debt and credit is that a lot of parents see the problem. So what they do is immediately jump in and pay off the bill because they don't want their child to have debt. But then what ends up happening is that then it reinforces bad behavior. You don't want to reinforce bad behavior. I think all of us would say that if we knew of a parent who had a child that had a car accident, and after the car accident, the parent went out and bought the child another car when it was his or her fault,
yeah.
We would say you're actually enabling bad behavior. And yet when parents in with all the best motives in the world, pay off their child's credit card debt, they are, in a sense, reinforcing and actually enabling bad behavior. So I, in a sense, have 2 points. Number one, like I said, this is something that the church needs to warn young people about. And number two, it seems to me that parents have to start being parents, and sometimes tough love means you have to be willing to let them be forced to pay off their credit card and suffer the consequences, because when you step in to try to help them, you may be doing more harm than good.
You know, talking about this digital age of money that we're in, one of the challenges that I personally have faced is trying to keep track and actually, you know, be aware of where my money is going, when sometimes all it takes is the click of a key, the wave of a magic wand, you know, when you got some of those where you just have to tap your card on something. And you, it's so hard to keep track of things in this digital age where transfers can happen within a second. You know, you see all those credit card commercials, you know, it's faster and more convenient than cash, and which that never really made a lot of sense to me. Like, well, I don't know about faster. It takes just as long to reach into my wallet to pull out a credit card as it does pull out cash, so I don't see the faster part. But, you know, that's what we're sold on. We're sold on this idea of quick, fast money transfers. Don't even worry about it. Don't even think about it. Just do it, and it'll be fine. How can we be better managers of our money in this digital age where everything is so instantaneous? You know, they're even talking about, you know, you can go to a grocery store and just push your cart through scanners here in the near future, and just scan everything and automatically pull it out of your account. You won't even have to do anything. It's almost impossible to keep track of my money that way.
Well, and I think you have to come back to some key principles. One is, I love John Maxwell, because he said a budget is telling your money where it should go, rather than let your money tell you where it went.
I like
so
that.
A lot of this comes back to the issue of budget. Now, if you think about it, the scriptures are replete with all sorts of verses that tell us to plan, not only to plan financially, but to plan generally. For example, in Proverbs 16, it says, commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Proverbs 16:9, very famous verse. You know, the mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Proverbs 21:5, good planning and hard work lead to prosperity. So one of the things is that you should never be caught off guard. If you have a budget, like I said, a budget then tells your money where it goes. If you don't have a budget, then your money tells you where it went, and that's not what you want. And so it has always been true that a budget was crucial, and that was true up to the 20th century. But now that we find ourselves in the digital age in the 21st century, I think a budget is even more crucial. A budget says to you, this is the amount that you're going to spend for food. This is the amount you're going to spend for rent. This is the amount you're going to spend for entertainment. This may be the amount that you'll spend for something else. And if you have that budget, then you can begin to constrain your spending. If you do not, then you end up being like most Americans today, who find themselves spending more than they actually make, and as a result, that puts them into debt. It wasn't so long ago, you go back to the 1980s, that when you did the ratio between savings and disposable income, it was at 10%. Then in the 1990s, it was 5%. By the year 2000, it was zero, and shortly thereafter, it went into minus numbers. It used to be not so long ago that in America, we saved, and we do not anymore. We went from being the largest creditor nation in the world to the largest debtor nation in the world, but as consumers, we went from being savers to consumers. We would be able, I think, to go back and look at the way America used to be, or even the way certain countries in the world, Japan, for example, is notorious for having a significant amount of savings. So we can learn from other countries, we can learn from our past experience, but most importantly, I think we can just learn from the scriptures to make sure that we are saving and not always spending more than we take in.
Well, we're talking with Kirby Anderson, talking about making the most of your money in tough times, a book that he's put out that's full of practical advice. And going back to this budget idea, you know, I've tried some different things. I've even tried the envelope system when it comes to, you know, budgets. But again, going back to the fact that we live in a digital age, so often what I've run into is that, you know, having the cash on hand isn't always the best way to go about things, because a lot of what we do happens digitally, be it paying bills online, which may or may not be safer, you know, doing a lot of this type of stuff. So, you know, doing the envelope system to keep track of your budget, especially as I've gotten older and some of that budgetary stuff has gotten larger, that makes it hard. So what are some things that we can do to help manage our budget when we're in an age that so much of it is happening sometimes without us even, you know, the automatic withdrawals for this, that, or the other thing? You don't even think of it. The whole digital thing really scares me, to be honest.
Well, here, let's take a couple of basics. I've got a chapter there that talks about ATM cards. That's just one example. And it seems to me that you still can come up with this idea of a budget, but what you have to do is you need to, first of all, make sure that you keep an accurate record of what you withdraw. Don't forget to include some of those charges, because it's very easy to find out that although ATMs and ATM cards are very convenient, they can also be very expensive. Also, I think it's important to not expect that the ATM is going to give you an accurate balance for your checking account, because there may be checks that haven't cleared yet, don't show up on the balance. So in this digital age, I think it's still important to keep records. Now, you can keep all those records digitally, too. I mentioned a minute ago Crown Financial, which was started by Larry Brickett, continued on by Howard Dayton, and now today is actually run by Bruce Bentley. And they have, you know, something that you can put on your laptop computer. I travel around with my laptop. I also have an iPhone. There are just different ways you can keep track of that. And so even though it's happening digitally, you can still use digital records to keep track of it. Now, you raised a couple of other issues. One is, okay, what about direct deposit and then automatic withdrawal? Direct deposit, no biblical concern why not to do that. As a matter of fact, a lot of people find that it is an easier way to have your employer put your check automatically into your checking account. So if that's something that works well, that's fine. But again, make sure that you keep a record of that. Make sure that it cleared and that you weren't writing checks for something that was supposed to be deposited, say, on the 25th and didn't get deposited till the 27th, but you already wrote checks assuming that it cleared on the 25th. So there are some possible liabilities there. When you talk about the withdrawal, the automatic withdrawal, some people use that, for example, to support churches or ministry. Nothing necessarily wrong with that, although some individuals have pointed out that it may make you less likely to, say, pray for a ministry or something like that. Randy Alcorn talks about that in his book. I find this to be the case. Oftentimes when I'm writing a check to a Christian ministry, to a church, I tend to think more about praying for them. If it was automatically being deducted every month, I might forget that. But there, again, there's nothing necessarily unbiblical or even unwise about using that. As a matter of fact, the more you have things like a direct deposit and an automatic withdrawal, if that becomes part of your budget, becomes sort of your fixed cost. And for some of our listeners that don't exactly have an accountant or bookkeeper mindset, if a lot of that can be done automatically, then it helps you see very quickly how much money that you do have for disposable income, and that's what you can use in other areas of your life that wouldn't necessarily be withdrawn automatically from your checking account. So, again, even though we live in the digital age, some of those principles still apply, and we can even use digital records to keep track of the kinds of expenses and payments that we make here in the digital age.
Now, you mentioned, you know, we've mentioned a lot debt tonight, and debt is practically a way of life in America. In fact, a lot of people going into this financial crisis talked a lot about, you know, bad debts and all this other type of stuff, and I was thinking about it, and I've often been trying to figure out, is there any way to live completely debt-free? Because, quite frankly, I will never have enough cash on hand to buy a house. At least, I don't think I will, despite my best efforts. Certainly not on what they pay me to do radio. And often the case with cars, you know, there's just some things that are quote-unquote necessities of life that will never really be able to pay off in one big chunk. So is there any way really to live debt-free in our society?
Well, again, I think you have to come back to some basic principles. As I pointed out a minute ago, the scriptures do not say that thou shalt not inherit debt, or thou shalt not go into debt, but it does warn us in Proverbs 22, verse 7, that the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is a servant to the lender, or some of the translations say a slave to the lender. And by that, it means that when you are in debt, it begins to constrain your choices, just like being a slave, you know, can't do certain things because the master won't let him do that. Right now, I would have to say some of our listeners are saying, you know, I really wanted to go on a vacation this summer, but my spouse said, you know, well, we really can't afford so, you know, and so we're staying home. And so debt is not something that is completely always forbidden in the scriptures, but I would have to say that it is something that we want to avoid as much as possible. Now, there are different kinds of debt, so let me kind of sort that out, because you talked about different things.
Right.
The worst kind of debt to have would be credit card debt,
right,
because right now a lot of people are paying anywhere from 21-22% interest on a credit card. Oh, my gosh. I mean, if you just paid the minimum payment on your credit card, I mean, it would take you an enormous amount of time, literally decades, to pay that all off. And so this is an enormous rate of interest which is being charged on credit cards. And so those are the things you want to pay off very, very quickly if you're in debt. By contrast, let me look at something on the other end of the spectrum, which you just mentioned a minute ago, and that is a home mortgage. In most cases, home mortgages have been seen as a wiser form of debt, because in most cases you are asked to put a certain percentage down so that even if you were not able to continue paying on that mortgage, if you were able to sell that house, you would not lose a tremendous amount of money. You would not be what they call underwater. This is where the tough times have changed everything, because a lot of our listeners right now are underwater, and that is they owe more on their house than they could sell their house for. And so even in that situation, you recognize that it hasn't exactly been the best investment, but there's a good amount of evidence to suggest that eventually we're going to get back into a situation where the house prices will go up and fewer individuals will be underwater. But is it possible to live without debt? Yes, I know individuals that live without debt. Myself, except for my house, I do not owe anything for any car payment, any credit card, or anything like that. And that's because I've worked very hard to very carefully watch my own finances. And even in the case of my house, if I ever wanted to sell it, I would sell it for more than the amount owed on the house. And so as you get older, some of the things which seem almost impossible begin to be possible, simply because you are able to set aside resources that at the time looked very difficult to obtain, especially when you're younger. So it is possible to live without debt, but even if you have debt, it seems to me that you should evaluate the kind of debt you have. And if you have credit card debt, that's the first kind of debt that you want to try to pay off.
Now, we mentioned, or at least alluded to, right when we started the program, that yes, times are tough now, but for smart individuals, it could also be a time of opportunity if you know the right places to look. And I've heard that alluded to other places as well. Like, yeah, times are tough, but for the people who understand what's going on, this can be a time of opportunity. Can you expound on that? What kind of opportunities are presenting themselves right now, especially for maybe younger people such as myself, who you know, are going to be in it for a long run? You know, and I'm not facing retirement, so this whole financial crisis that's going on right now is not affecting my immediate retirement. It may,
no,
you know, down the road.
Yeah, we can talk about all sorts of options. Let me take one. I'm tonight just talking to you from my home, and my wife and I got into it a couple of years ago, but there is a couple just literally two doors down from us, and they were able to get into their home for at least $50,000 less than what we paid for our home. Now, they are a couple that isn't really any older than my children. And you might say, well, how did they do that? Well, because of this down housing market is a good example, they were able to take over a house that was a foreclosure. By the way, I might point out, my house wasn't a foreclosure, but it was a little bit of a distressed sale. So even there, like you, being in radio, being in ministry, don't have a lot of money, but if I was willing to come in and do some things, and we had to do quite a few, we painted, we put in gutters, we had to change out the electrical, we, you know, just on and on. and on and on. But if you're willing to do some of those kinds of things, this is one opportunity. Another is that if you do have concerns about inflation in the future, you might say, well, if I'm going to do certain kinds of investments, I would want to do some investments that are going to be a hedge against inflation. That gets into the chapter of talking about gold and silver. Now, a lot of people say, well, I can't buy a whole lot. You know what? When I started doing it, I would buy, every once in a while, I'd have some extra cash, I would buy one gold coin, put it aside. But, you know, now I have quite a number of those. And so there are just some things that, even in a down economy, provide opportunities. You might also, if you want to look at more risky, quote, risky investments, there are certain kinds of stocks that have been fairly low. You can start seeing that some of them are going to come back. There are people that make their living providing wise financial counsel. Some of those people might even be in your own church. I mean, there is a lot of in the scriptures that say that we should find wisdom from godly counselors, and there is wisdom from many counselors, and some of them might point you to various places of investment. But the most important one is the younger you are, the greater opportunity you can begin to build up some financial resources because of the what's called the eighth wonder of the world, the miracle of compounding interest. And setting aside a little bit of money when you're in your 20s is going to yield a much greater yield in your 60s than setting aside that same money when you were, say, in your 30s and 40s. So sometimes younger is better because it gives you a longer period of time not only to put money aside, but also important enough to build upon the interest rates that will maximize your return.
Now, we've talked a lot about hypotheticals and planning for the future and all this stuff on how to ride out the current tough financial time. But for some people, it's a lot more real than hypotheticals and stuff that's happening in the future. You know, people have lost jobs. We go down to the rescue mission once a month to serve breakfast down there, and we've often talked with the people down there about how this economy has affected people coming in to get food because you know, they can't quite make ends meet. What kind of advice would you give to people who have been hit hardest by this, especially those in the job market? It's like, I am looking for a job, but I can't find one. And in the meantime, my expenses keep piling up. What am I supposed to do about that? Or, you know, my mortgage is out of control. Or, you know, what would you tell people who are experiencing this recession in a very real personal way?
Look, sir. Well, you, again, almost could write a book on it, but let me take two points each time. I'll try to take a couple just to give some illustrations.
Sure.
First of all, if you have lost your job, one of the things you need to do is make sure that you have some kind of medical insurance. Now, if you've lost your job, that means you can go on to COBRA. And the reason I say that is the reason that you want to think about this is that you need some kind of insurance, and it could be something with a very high deductible, and it could maybe just be catastrophic care. But the last thing that you want to do is be in a situation where if, Lord forbid, someone in your family or you comes down with a catastrophic illness or are involved in a car accident, those are situations from which it is very difficult to recover, and that's one of the reasons there is such a debate right now in Congress about the issue of health care reform and catastrophic care. So in my chapter, which is perhaps the longest chapter on insurance, because I look at everything from life insurance and car insurance and medical insurance and all the rest, it seems to me that you have to make sure that you continue on some kind of insurance, and if you have been working for a company that has been paying that, you need to have something there to cover that issue. Hmm. Now, back to the point that you were really asking, okay, I can't pay all my bills. Communication is key. I have done programs with people in the banking industry, and there are two kinds of people that surface when they've lost their job and can't pay their bills. The first group, and unfortunately it's the largest group, say, well, I can't pay my bills, so I just won't communicate with them. Maybe I'll, you know, drop off the radar, or maybe they'll forget about me or whatever. And that's the absolute worst thing to do, and yet that is the natural tendency to do that. The best thing to do is to immediately communicate with a mortgage company, communicate with a credit card company, and explain that you've lost your job. That at least gives them some data that goes into the computers and gives them a little bit more of an understanding of your situation. Now, the good news is that sometimes, in certain circumstances, when somebody's lost their job, there have been some companies and corporations that have even given you a fair amount of grace period. But even if they don't, that's the good news. Even if you get the bad news and they say you still owe all of this, at least you've communicated, so the chances of them wanting to foreclose on your house, repossess your car, or get involved in something that is going to be obviously even more catastrophic for your family is less likely to take place. At that point, then, communication not only with the people you owe, but then building a network. I've interviewed people in the past that have developed whole ministries to help people find jobs, working in networks and trying to talk to all their friends, neighbors, and coworkers and business associates to see if they can find another job opportunity. Those are things that, of course, you want to begin almost immediately. But you have to kind of plan your situation. And here, again, is where a budget would be very helpful, because you were basing all of your expenses and income on one set and ratio. Now, if you have a different set of income, you can at least have a budget that you could even show your creditors, so that it might help them understand that you're doing the best that you can in the circumstances you have until you can find another job to begin to replenish some of your financial resources.
Well, we're talking with Kirby Anderson, author of the book Making the Most of Your Money in Tough Times. And before we run out of time, Kirby, everyone really wants to know, are things going to get better? And what would your assessment of the possibility of things getting better be in the near future or in the long run?
Sure. And in the short run, I would have to say that we already are seeing some very significant signs of improvement. For example, Dow Jones went up to 9,000. Well, we can remember a time when some people thought it would be at 5,000. Now, it's nowhere near where it was before. So near term, you've seen some improvement, but I don't think we're going to see a massive recovery simply because of the kind of spending. Recognize we spent $787 billion just on the stimulus package.
Mm-hmm.
If we end up spending more on cap and trade and health care reform, that, I think, takes the direction the wrong way.
Hmm.
But long term, I think any wise and prudent individual has to recognize that something has got to change. Either government has got to stop spending and having to require more taxes and more borrowing. And if it does not, it can only tax so much, it can only borrow so much, and eventually it will start printing. And so I think long term, it seems more realistic that any wise investor is going to deal with this issue of inflation. And that's why you're having more and more people talking about investing part of your portfolio in gold and silver or other kinds of metals or precious metals that actually maintain some level of value at a time when the currency that you're receiving every day is worth less and less because of inflation. So short term, I think we're going to see a little more improvement. Long term, there are some real issues on the horizon that need to be addressed, and that's really the principle of the book. We as individuals, first of all, need to get out of debt. We as a country, number two, need to get out of debt, and we need to apply some of these principles to actually leave for our children and grandchildren a much better world than they find right now.
Well, thanks for all the advice. I mean, I know you helped me out. If nothing else, it's one of the advantages of having your own radio program. You can have experts like you on. So, hey, can I ask you a question? But if people want to find out more about you, your ministry, your radio program, where can they go and find out more about what you do?
Well, the radio show that many people hear is a show called Point of View, and you can just simply go to pointofview.net. The whole series that we have preceding this, A Biblical Point of View, there's four books in that series. This is a standalone book called Making the Most of Your Money in Tough Times. But if you go to pointofview.net, you can order any or all the books, and we make a package available, so you can order them individually for $10 or a package for less than $10 a book.
Well, Kirby Anderson, thank you so much for hanging out with me tonight. And I'm actually working sans producer. I'm the only one in the studio right now, so that's why I wasn't able to take anybody's calls. I would have loved to have done that, but it would have made things really, really hard. So as we wrap things up tonight, hang on, Kirby, and I'll talk to you as soon as I rush out of the studio, push some buttons, and get things going. And but thank you so much for your time tonight. And
thank you.
Yeah, and as for everyone else, next Sunday on Raw Talk, is going to be a very different kind of Raw Talk. It's going to be a special Raw Talk because we talk a little bit about finding healing and forgiveness after abortion. You know, we hear a lot about the abortion issue right now, especially with some of the healthcare reform that's going on. And we all know that abortion is wrong. The church, as the moral authority on the subject, has made that part very, very clear. But nevertheless, whether we like to acknowledge or not, it happens. And what happens after it happens? Where is the church after it happens? Where do we go after it happens? How can we find healing and forgiveness in a post-abortion time? And so it's going to be a very personal show for myself and one that I hope will minister to a lot of you. So, you know, tell your friends. I know this is a volatile subject, but it's one that we need to talk about because we have to talk about what happens after this takes place. And so we're going to examine that next week, and I hope you'll join us for a very special and what I'm sure is going to be an emotional Raw Talk. That'll be next Sunday on Raw Talk, and I'd be happy to have you guys join us next week. And don't forget, also next Saturday, or this coming Saturday, I should say, is the golf tournament. You can help support the music ministry of M88 by just playing some golf. Come make fun of me as I try to do my best to play golf as well. So, sans producer, you're now going to hear me walk out of the studio and push some buttons and get things rolling the way they're supposed to, so don't mind the dead silence that you might hear for a minute or so as I arrange things all on my own. And just keep in mind, man, that Yo is a super guy. He can do a show all by himself, and it's just the kind of talent I have. But pray for me. I hope you guys have a Shway week in the Lord.
Thanks for joining us on Raw Talk on M88. Get the podcast of tonight's show free at m88.org. And join us again next week for more Raw Talk on M88.